Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Conversations Live. For more than a decade, we've brought you the best in books, entertainment, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us first. Now, here's your host, Cyrus Webb.
And welcome back, everyone, to Conversations Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. Award-winning journalist and author Joe Urschel is making his first appearance on our program today to talk to us not only about his new book, The Year of Fear, but what it was like for him to chronicle the journey of Machine Gun Kelly and the manhood that changed the nation, but also, I think, the individuals that were able to stand up against those who were threatening to not only terrorize individuals, but also, of course, to be able to cause havoc as well. We're going to talk to Joe not only about what led him to write this book, but what it's been like for him already to hear from audiences about what they're appreciating about it. Joe, hello to you and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Joe, you know, I know it's been already a busy time for you. The book was just released this month. It's already an Amazon.com bestseller, and people are already talking about, I think, and not only some of the bigger parts of the story, but also what it was like for them, like myself, to learn about them for the very first time for many of us. What has it been like for you to not only to unravel what is, for many of us, a hidden part of history, but also to share this important story?
Well, I first stumbled upon this back in the early 80s when I first moved to Washington, and on a visit to the Library of Congress, I went into their great reading room, and they had just converted their card catalog indexing system over to a computer database. This is real early in the digital revolution. So I went over to the computer data bank and just typed in my last name, which is very unusual.
Right.
And one entry came up. Now, keep in mind, the Library of Congress is thought to be the greatest collection of knowledge in the world. Okay, so
right.
One entry comes up, and it's Charles Urschel, kidnap victim. And there was one book in the library about it that was written in 1934, the year after the incident. And it was written by a business partner of Charles Urschel. And so I sat down, I read this book cover to cover, and it was just an amazing story that could have been the outline of a Dashiell Hammett detective story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just had so many great twists and turns and incredible consequences that I was just fascinated with it. So, of course, I went to my dad and I said, have you heard about this guy? Are we related to him? And, of course, he says, no. So I immediately set out, like any good son, to prove him wrong, did some genealogical research, and it turns out, you know, we're really not closely related. Our relationship would go back centuries to Germany. But nevertheless, I stayed amazed by this story and amazed by the fact that I knew nothing about it. Although I thought I knew something about Machine Gun Kelly, everybody sort of knows that name. But it turns out that he's a very different man than you would have imagined him. And it was just such a great journey to uncover all of this knowledge about this Charles Urschel, this incredible, irascible oil man, rags-to-riches guy who gets kidnapped by this dangerous criminal and then sets out on a path after he's released to track him down, find him, capture him, and make sure he goes to jail and make sure he gets his money back.
Right, exactly. And that is what was so fascinating for me. For one, because I would say 99% of this journey that you cover in the book, The Year of Fear, Joe, I had never heard of. When I was talking to some of my friends who were a little bit more schooled in history than I was, maybe, you know, they were like, you know, well, as you said, they know the name Machine Gun Kelly, but did not know a lot of the intricacies that you cover in this book. I was curious from that time, and you know, with the card catalog until now, I mean, how much time would you say it took to, you know, to chronicle what is now The Year of Fear?
Well, once I really got into it, completing the research and completing the writing, it probably took me about 2.5-3 years. I call it the Year of Fear. It's 1933 because FDR had just taken office. In his inaugural address, he said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." But in fact, there was a lot of things to fear. I mean, it was the worst year of the Depression, you know. In some cities, 80% of the workforce was out of work, and the country was in a terrible state. Banks were closing, farms were being repossessed, and it was the beginning of the Dust Bowl, where you had these incredible dust storms that would kick up in Texas and Oklahoma and blow silt so thick and strong it would kill cattle in the fields. It would stop cars in their tracks. It would blow all the way to New England and turn the snow red. I mean, it's just this horrific environmental disaster. And of course, there was at the same time this incredible sense of lawlessness around the country, where these criminals who were running gin, running liquor operations, and robbing banks for a living, suddenly were finding themselves robbing banks that didn't have any money in them. And the end of Prohibition was on the horizon. Prohibition ends in 1933, so that business is beginning to dry up. So they turn to this kind of heinous crime of kidnapping people for profit. And what they would do is look around and try to find wealthy people who they knew had money and snatch them, hold them for ransom, and then release them when the ransom was paid, but release them with the threat that if you go to the authorities, we'll come back and not only kill you, but kill your entire family. So very few people cooperated with law enforcement after they were released.
Yeah. And you discussed one of the fascinating chapters for me, Joe, was chapter number three of the Kidnapping Scourge. And you talk about in there how, you know, there was not only the fear that was instilled in them, but also, you know, the brazen nature that they would do this. You know, as you talk about the ham kidnapping, you know, individuals just walking up to him. And I thought about even today in 2015, we're always so leery of someone who just walks up to us. And in that day, of course, you know, people, it seemed like, were a lot more friendlier. But, you know, even, you know, not knowing what people's motives were, you know, was it interesting for you, the reason why I bring that up, was it interesting for you to see how there are so many parallels to the world that we live in today, even going back to the 1930s during this time?
Oh, absolutely. I think what you have are... You have a really strong parallel, of course, with the drug wars, where you've got, especially in Mexico, where kidnapping for profit is a huge business these days. But it's also the sense of, you know, kind of dangerous street crime that you just, you know, this remains a very violent, well-armed society that we're living in. And at the time, in 1933, it was even worse than it is now. I mean, the murder rate was twice what it is now, and even fewer murders were solved. And this was a situation, you know, where you've got big criminal families running the political operations in New York and Chicago and St. Louis and Kansas City. And the Europeans were, who didn't share this kind of violence, were just fascinated with America. And, you know, in this case with the Machine Gun Kelly manhunt and trial, they sent reporters, you know, from all over Europe to cover this.
Right. And I think, again, that is what makes it so fascinating. We all have heard that saying that truth is sometimes stranger than fiction, and I think definitely in the case of Machine Gun Kelly, that is true. But those who are just tuning in, he's on the Radio Dollar Online. You're listening to Conversations Live. I'm speaking today with Joe Urschel. He's not only an award-winning journalist, but the author of the new book out this year, The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. There also were individuals that did stand up for what was right, and we see the emergence of J. Edgar Hoover in this as well. I'm going to talk more about that later, Joe. But I want to talk about the nature of Machine Gun Kelly, because I think it's so interesting in him, and I wanted to know what your thoughts were about this, because as I was reading the book, I thought this is not your typical, what you would look at as a typical gangster, a typical criminal. He was someone who was very calculating, I mean, smart, and was not one of these individuals, I think, that was afraid. You know, there's a great letter that was written that you share in the chapter Catching Kelly, and where he writes actually to Charles, who you mentioned earlier, Charles Urschel, you know, and just really, I mean, saying very clearly what his thoughts were about him, what he planned on doing to him, as well as, of course, to others. I mean, what was it like for you to unearth all of that and really get a clear profile of who he was?
Well, that was just fascinating to me, because Machine Gun Kelly, George Barnes is his real name, he is simply the creation of the mythology that Hoover created after his arrest, and Hollywood created off of that name. Kelly himself was not one of these up from poverty, dangerous psychopaths who were roaming the Wild West back then. I mean, he grew up in middle class. He went to college for a semester. He was a really smart guy. He set himself up in he started his liquor running business when he was in high school, basically by blackmailing his father into giving him the family car and a huge allowance. And then he just built it from that until he got caught selling liquor on an Indian reservation, which, of course, is a federal crime. So he ends up in Leavenworth Prison for 3 years, where he meets all of these really, really dangerous criminals and murderers and bank robbers, whom he befriends and uses his connections and his accounting skills and his business acumen to forge papers and enable their escape. And as payback for that, they tell him, once you get out of prison, if you're ever looking for work, you come to the Green Lantern Tavern in St. Paul, Minneapolis, which is where we operate from, and we'll set you up. So when he gets out, he does. And he gets involved with a number of, you know, the true criminal class that was operating out of St. Paul, Minnesota at the time, and just starts robbing banks with reckless abandon. But he didn't particularly like a violent confrontation in a bank robbery. In fact, he preferred robbing banks with a concealed .38. He was one of these hail fellow well-met guys. You know, he's a real charmer. He dressed like $1 million. And he'd just walk into a bank like he was a customer and throw a couple of satchels over the counter and show the tellers his concealed .38 and tell them just fill up the bags.
Right. Right, and to think that he was not along this journey on his own. I mean, his wife, it wasn't as if she was unaware of what was happening. I mentioned earlier the chapter, The Kidnapping Scourge. You even talk about his wife, Catherine, in that chapter, and how, I mean, this was something that she took a lot of pride in. I mean, what was that like for you to uncover, you know, her own intent in all of this?
Well, she, as well as Hoover, she is responsible for creating this image of Machine Gun Kelly. She was a very, you know, acquisitive, glamour queen, gangster moll, a real tough character. Kelly was her third husband. It's thought that she had murdered her second husband when she caught him cheating. So she hooks up with Kelly, and they have this great, you know, sort of gangster love affair, but she never liked the way Kelly operated. He wanted to be an under the radar kind of guy, and she wanted him to be, you know, a famous headline gangster like the John Dillingers of the country at the time. So she actually bought him the machine gun, and then spread stories around Dallas and Texas and Oklahoma and every speakeasy that she went into about how good he was with it, saying that he could shoot walnuts off a fence post and write his name on the side of a barn with it. And so that's really how the legend got born. And she was the one who wanted to get into the kidnapping game. And she came up with this scheme where she was going to she wanted him and his partner to kidnap first Urschel and then another series of four other people subsequently, that would ultimately net them about $1 million in ransom, and they'd go off and live happily ever after in Juarez, Mexico.
Right, right. You mentioned Urschel again, and I want to talk about him and, you know, the way we look at victims today, because, I mean, you're able to spend a lot of time in, you know, the book, The Year of Fear, Joe, and allowing us to know who he was and the kind of individual that he, you know, evolved into being even after this kidnapping. I want to talk about, though, the way that you were able to glean how he was able to help in the end, because, you know, you chronicle in the book about how even though he was blindfolded, as readers will see for those who haven't read it, he was able to use his senses in other ways to kind of keep in tune to smells and voices and those kind of things. I mean, what was that like for you, even though, as you say, you know, you found out you weren't any, you know, direct, you know, a descendant of his? What was it like for you to see how he was able to be instrumental in helping in this?
Well, that's one of my main motivators in writing this book, because I wanted people to know about Charles Urschel, because more than anyone else, he's responsible for solving this crime and for launching the career of J. Edgar Hoover and the subsequent creation of the FBI. He was a tough farm kid who, after World War One and serving in the Army, decided he was going to go off to Oklahoma and Texas and try to make his try to break into the oil business, which he does very successfully. But you know, the oil business at that time was a real rough and tumble kind of Wild West existence, and so after he builds this company, and he was thought to be the wealthiest oil man in the Southwest at the time, he ends up getting kidnapped by Kelly and his gang, and as they drive him away, they blindfold him, they tape his eyes shut, and they plug up his ears and tape his ears shut. So for 8 days while he's being held, he's basically blind and he can't hear much. But he resolves that he is going to figure out where he is, and he's going to lead the law enforcement back to this farm where they held him outside of Dallas, Texas. And so he begins collecting information. Having grown up on a farm, he knows he's on a farm. He knows what kind of animals are there. He knows about how many. He figures out how big the farm is, how many buildings are on it. He knows the name of the local postman. He knows where the floorboards run from east to west and west to east. And he starts leaving his fingerprints any place he can. And he also notices that at 9:30 in the morning and at 5:30 in the afternoon, a plane goes overhead. And so when he's ultimately released, given all these threats that he's under, he goes immediately back to his house where, of course, there's all kinds of law enforcement and members of the press there. And he goes right to Gus Jones, who was the special agent in charge of the investigation for J. Edgar Hoover. And he says, and he immediately begins to cooperate with him. And Gus Jones tells him, you know, finding these guys is going to be like finding a needle in a haystack. But then he debriefs him, and they talk for 2.5 hours. And when he's done, Jones says, well, you know, the haystack just got a lot smaller. And so they're able to figure out where it is from all this information. And Urschel insists that he be part of the raiding party that goes in to take them down, and he's in the lead car with Jones, and he's got a sawed-off shotgun across his lap.
Amazing. And I think, too, you know, your idea of what justice is, even in the 1930s, it's so interesting in looking at the words of Keenan after the trial for Urschel. I wanted to share a part of that. It's in the chapter, The G-Man Takes the Spotlight, Chapter 10, and it's referencing what you mentioned earlier, Joe, and that being FDR's war on crime. Keenan says this is just a skirmish. We are going right on down the line until every predatory criminal and gangster in the United States is exterminated. The new law has proven a powerful weapon, and we are eager to use it to the finish. Reflecting on that statement in the 1930s and looking at, you know, where we are now in 2015, I was curious. I mean, what do you think about those words in light of where we are now? Do you think things, you know, have really, when it comes to the law, that the laws have been tailored to be able to really address the real problems that are affecting us when it comes to crime?
Well, I certainly think we've made a lot of progress. This 1933, 1934, that was really the beginning of what we call the war on crime. You know, it's a war that definitely has not been won. But if you look back to 1933, you've got a nation with a very weak law enforcement system in place. There were only 11 state police forces at the time. There was no FBI. There was no national police force. The FBI at the time, they were called the Bureau, but they were not a law enforcement agency that even carried weapons, and they didn't have the power of arrest. So all of that began to change after 1934. And of course, the FBI begins, you know, to arm up and get weapons training, and they're an incredibly viable police force and investigative unit. Now, of course, they're going after terrorists and all kinds of things. But after 1933, you begin to see laws put in place that enable, particularly the federal government, to enforce laws across the country.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, again, this book really shows us how, as you said, it was a big emergence for Hoover, but also, of course, for us to be able to know that, I mean, especially in cases, as Keenan does say, this is just a skirmish, that there are times, you know, that we can look at and say, you know, justice does win. And this was one of the cases, as in the case of Machine Gun Kelly. Again, everyone, you've been listening to Conversations Live. Joe Urschel has been our guest. He's not only an award-winning journalist, but also the author of the new book, as you can tell from this conversation, really fascinating, The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly, and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. So after you've put in the years that you did in researching this, and now that the book is available for the world to be able to read. And Joe, I know you said that you really wanted people to know about Urschel, but what do you hope they're able to take away from it by taking this journey with you back in time?
Well, I think I think the book is a good reflection on where the country was at that time. I mean, this country was not at all what it is now back in 1933. This is pre-war. The country's in a terribly poverty-stricken state, but somehow we managed to pull ourselves out of it. And after the Second World War, you know, you have this great industrial buildup, and the nation expands, and there's a great sense of optimism around. I think that if you want to look at it politically, this is the beginning of when people began to put faith in the federal government. The federal government was, pretty much reviled and held at arm's length in the 20s and 30s and even in the early 40s. But you have FDR, of course, who was the great proponent of federal programs coming into office. And that begins this whole, federalizing of government. And wherever you come down politically on that now, I think, the nation is starting to change back and say, we want to get the federal government off our back. But I think this book, it gives you a good sense of what life can be like when you have a weak federal government.
Exactly. I totally agree. And I think, again, so many great lessons and great parallels that we're able to take this journey back to the 1930s, and we have you to thank for that for sure. The book is available through our friends at Amazon.com. Of course, you can always go to your favorite bookstore if they don't have it there. Make sure you guys order it. They'll be glad to be able to get it for you. And, Joe, what about you? How can our audience stay connected with you as well?
Well, you can follow me at the National Law Enforcement Museum. On our website, we have a number of programs, and if you're ever in Washington, you can come by and see us. We haven't actually built the building yet, but we're in the process of doing that, and we're, of course, always eager to talk about our project and what we think it will mean to both the city and the museum-going population in the country.
Well, I really appreciate the time today. As I said, I know it's been a busy time for you with the release of the new book, but look, we really appreciate you stopping by and looking forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you, Cyrus.
Hey, thank you for the time. And we thank you, our audience, for joining us for another great segment of Conversations Live. For our radio audience, you all stay where you are. There's more Conversations Live to come at the bottom of the hour. For those joining us online, though, we are going to lose you. So if you came in late and missed part of the conversation, don't worry. Thanks to our online friends, you all can catch the replay right now. It's available on demand. Just go over to our social media sites at facebook.com/CyrusWeb or head over to twitter.com/CyrusWeb. You can click on the link there, listen to the show completely for free, and even share with your friends from there. I want to thank our good friends with Open Book Publicity for setting up this conversation with us for today. And again, thank all of you for tuning in, both for our radio audience as well as us tuning in online. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Make sure you take out time to enjoy some good music as well as a great book. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live today. You all make it a great one.